For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to have speaking tonight Jeremy, who has just returned from 3 months at Tassajara Monastery, deep in the mountains east of Big Sur, where I lived for a few years in the early 80s, and the training monastery in our tradition here in America of from Suzuki Roshi lineage in San Francisco Zen Center. And Jeremy is also our new work leader. So one of the things that we do, even though this is a non-residential storefront little zendo in Chicago, the way we take care of this temple is based on the patterns of monastic training from Tassajara and going back to Japan and China. So we have various training positions. Work leader is one of them. And we just have rotated positions. So we have, just to announce, our new Eno is Roy, and our new Tenzo is Aishin, and our new director is Douglas. None of them are here, but continuing as head dough on is Dave, and Laurel's continuing as assistant director. And Caitlin is our assistant Tenzo. So it takes many people to take care of the practice. We also have Adam and Ben here, and Laurel, who are on the board, and Gary, who is one of our Ethics and Reconciliation Council people. And so anyway, and other people here do other tasks here. But anyway, Jeremy's new job, his new training position is as work leader, and so that's partly just taking care of the temple cleaning on Sundays, but also kind of taking care of the whole, you know, physical space that we are practicing in. So anyway, Jeremy, thank you very much for speaking tonight, and take it away.
Thank you, and good evening, everybody. I'd like to start by thanking my teacher, Taigen, who's sitting right next to me. Quite literally without him, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to Tassajara. And it's kind of great have this experience, because I really saw that just because you have a great experience of the Dharma, actual living experience, does not mean that you are going to be available to teach others. And there are those who have, you know, great experience and they live great lives and they don't go on to be teachers, and the ones that do are a rare breed. And so, thank you. And also, Christina, I'm going to botch her name, she's from Switzerland, Lenher, who is the abbess, amazing teacher. She is totally into body practice, and learned a lot from her. Tanto, Greg Fain, and Leslie James, and Linda Gallion, the rest of the Sangha, and since this is a tradition that has existed for thousands of years, I could go on and thank all Buddhas and ancestors, because without their practice from year to year, I would have no practice, quite literally. And in practicing this way, I am practicing with all Buddhas and ancestors, and feel supported by them daily. So thank you for chanting the Heart Sutra. The abbess pointed to this line in particular, the line that says, "With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana." And she said, I think that, you know, the Heart Sutra says a lot of things. It doesn't say a lot of things, but I think she pointed to this particular part as saying that the Bodhisattva has no abode. Let's just leave it at that, it's fine. And in this no abode, great liberation and nirvana is found. And I'll come back to that. So, first of all, the first month, there's 3 months in a practice period. And the first month started off with what's called Tungaryo, which is 5 days straight of sitting, zazen. You get 3 30-minute breaks throughout the day. You're allowed to adjust your position. There's no walking meditation. The idea basically is to just stay in your seat as long as you possibly can. You know, it's not like a masochistic kind of thing. It's just have the intention of staying in your seat. Take care of yourself as best you can. If you need to use the bathroom, get up and use the bathroom. But for 5 days is, you know, sitting zazen. You're not allowed to shower. And there's only three places really to be, the zendo, the bathroom, or your cabin for 30-minute breaks and sleeping. And it was kind of put kind of clearly, you should not be anywhere else but these three places. And I think, you know, I think I took it really personal the first couple of days. I felt like it was like a hazing ritual. And, you know, it was... That didn't make it easier to sit. But what did make it easier to sit was the second day, they made cheesecake and left little bits of cheesecake on our seats when we came back from lunch break. And so I thought, well, this feels like a hazing ritual, and it feels like they don't care about me because they just make me sit in the seat, but they just gave me cheesecake, and cheesecake is like my favorite thing, so they must really care about me. That was excellent. But by day five, I was ready to stop sitting. And I felt like on day five, I actually had forgotten everything I knew about zazen. I felt like I didn't know how to sit zazen anymore. Around day four of Tungaryo, I hurt my back pretty bad. I didn't, you know, it's kind of helpful for me, and your bodies are all different, which is wonderful. But it's helpful for me to tilt my pelvis a little bit forward to get a little bit of a, you know, support for my back. And I didn't do that. I kind of just sat with my back straight. And so my back kind of bulged a little bit and I kind of got sick because I didn't have any energy. And I had to lie down. So by the fifth day, I was definitely done sitting. And I had a new body at day five. And that permeated the first month of sitting. I didn't really know how to cope with it. You know, I had to learn how to sit with the new body. So the schedule pretty much goes like this. You wake up at 3:50 a.m. and you go to sleep at 9 o'clock. And in that time, there's about 6 to 7 hours of zazen, depending on if there's a Dharma talk or not, or a Dharma event. 3 hours of work every day. And, you know, the work can be anything from, you know, kitchen to drawing. One person had a job of drawing cartoon animals for invitations for the Chuseo event. Hauling dirt. One time I was carrying water up a mountain to clean the solar panels. That was interesting. For most of the practice period, I worked in the kitchen. And that was... it was very difficult for me because I didn't think very much of my skill in cooking or preparing food, and didn't really know how to use a knife, which you need to know how to use a knife if you're going to work in Tassajara kitchen. And that stuff actually was really relatively easy. The hard part was, you know, depending on where you were set up, you might be facing a window. And through this window, you might see a person walking by at a casual pace. As if there's nothing going on or nothing wrong, and you're in this kitchen having to get this, you know, assignment done very quickly. And for me, that was difficult because I thought, you know, how am I slaving in here in this kitchen when this person is just, you know, having the time of their life at Tassajara. And that was really wonderful. There's the cliche that in Zen circles that, you know, when you say something you don't like, the person responds with, well, that's really good practice, you should sit with that. And that cliche just happens over and over and over again at Tassajara, because there's just so much to rattle you that, you know, it's not there to rattle you, but since, you know, you're waking up at 3:50 in the morning and you're going to bed at 9, it's, you know, maybe 5.5 hours of sleep if you're lucky. You can get rattled pretty easily in the beginning there. But Tassajara is beautiful. It is in a valley in the mountains. Everywhere you look, it's like a postcard. The coffee tea area is beautiful. The dining hall is beautiful. The kitchen's beautiful. The mountains are beautiful. The zendo is beautiful. Everything's wonderful. It looks so pretty. And the food is so good. All the ingredients that they have there are come in weekly. It's very fresh food. It's sometimes just more than just weekly. And they have bathhouses there. Like somewhat traditional Japanese bathhouses where you take a shower before you go in, so you wash before you go into these things that are called plunges. And then the plunges are about 108 degrees Fahrenheit, so they're very, very warm. And it can feel like, when you're not used to it, it can feel like you're jumping into a lake of cold water. And that's amazing. It's really great. You know, you sit 5 days in Tongariro, your whole body hurts, and then you go to the plunge, and it's, you know, it's heaven. And that lasted, all that stuff lasted for about a week. Tassajara was pretty for a week. The food was great for a week. The bathhouse was great for a week. It all got old real quick. Real quick. Because Tassajara is kind of like, if you imagine a ship in the middle of an ocean, it's kind of like what Tassajara is. You can't leave so much. You can't go on the internet. The phone is, if you know how to plan your calls well and the other person's available, the phone's kind of available, but it's hard to make a phone call. So all the things that I had in society were taken away real quick. And all the distractions are gone. And even though the distractions are gone, the habits don't go anywhere. They go with you. Well, they went with me, at least. Didn't have any friends there. The community that existed at the time, great community. But at month one, I didn't know anybody, and it was very difficult. There's kind of like a behavior that... you kind of assume when you've lived in a monastic community for a while, you know that you don't have much time to do anything. And so you kind of learn how to, use your time effectively. And using your time effectively does not always mean, talking to the new guy and getting to know him. Sometimes that means, going very quickly between places and getting all your stuff done. And I didn't understand that at all. I felt very, very isolated that first month. Incredibly isolated. A lot of days crying, which is not something that's all that rare for Tassajara. I think Steve Stuckey used to say that Tassajara is known for its hot springs. The ones that are there that you can bathe in, and the ones that flow from your eyes. The abbess would say, your habitual body comes with you. And my habitual body came with me. And I was, I have a list of things here, that kind of irked me. I think one of the things that came to the forefront was I had this great desire to be liked. Great desire to be liked. And as I've said, the people there didn't have the time to let me know if they liked me or if they didn't like me. So I got to make up all the stories I wanted. I think that was the biggest one. It was this constant desire to be liked. And when I didn't get it, when I didn't get what I wanted, isolation followed. And that was interesting. And also that first month, the death of Steve, or not death, sorry, the diagnosis of Steve Suki was announced. And at Tassajara, you know, he's put so much work into Tassajara. I mean, he permeates Tassajara. He wasn't there, but he was there. You know, when his diagnosis was announced, there was a board meeting, and the board came to the dining room. We all met, and the board was like, okay, well, this is what's going on with Steve, and why don't we all just tell stories about Steve Suki? And I didn't have any stories to tell, but I got to watch all of these people recollect their very intimate moments with Steve Suki, and he was there. I mean, it was wonderful. I used the word wonderful, to kind of express my feelings about the whole situation, being an outsider seeing it. And the tanto, Greg Fain, said, yes, it is wonderful. It's tragically wonderful. And I think that it was. It was beautiful to see all these people grieving. And it was beautiful to see this community come together. It's so tightly knit. And I think after that, I started to understand the people there a lot better. It's very tribal, was one of the words that was given to me by someone who lived in the community. But yeah, first month, I think I made one friend, a woman named Ursula, German, who she could only be there for 1 month too. And she left at the first end of the first month, and that was difficult because that was the only person I had to talk to. But it was important. It was kind of, you know, I didn't tell her this. Maybe I should. But it's kind of important that she left because, you know, she distracted me a lot because she was so funny. And we had these stupid jokes. Just to tell you how stupid the joke was, that in the kitchen, you have different sizes of chops that they'll ask you. They'll say, like, we would like a potato medium-large chop. And that was hilarious to us, that they wanted a medium large chop of the tomato, and that was just like a, you know, a size of a cube. And that just brightened my day. So when she left, there was no medium large chop to be talked about. That was great though that she left. I would have loved if she stayed though. So month two, I start to get used to the daily life, and isolation starts to transform into solitude. And I really start to learn how to live alone amongst a community, and not in a way of being an isolated individual, being someone who's fully there with the whole community, participating in solitude. Going back to the quote of the Heart Sutra, you know, when without hindrance there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. I think this started to become a reality for me because I stopped turning into the isolated inverted views and was realizing this kind of expansive reality was going on. It was wonderful. One of the things I used to kind of fill my time was I studied, like my head was on fire. One of the inhabitants of Tassajara, she said to me, she said, wow, you're studying the Dharma in your free time. She said, that's interesting. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm only here for 3 months, but really it was because I needed to have something to fill my time. And I came across a sutra that I'd like to introduce that I think, you know, I won't be able to properly tell you what was going on at Tassajara with me at the time. It was mystical and wonderful. But I think this sutra gets there. And it's the sutra that's attributed to the direct quote of the historical Buddha. The Pali name, I believe, is Bhadakarata Sutta. And the title is The Sutra on Knowing the Better Way to Live Alone. How wonderful. Yeah, let's just jump in right in. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because I think that would be a bit much. But basically, the Buddha calls a bunch of monks to get together, gathers the assembly, and says, I want to explain to you a teaching, what is meant by knowing the better way to live alone. So it goes as such. Maybe this would be better with my glasses on. Okay, so Buddha says, everyone listen carefully. They all say, we're listening. And he says, do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has not yet come. Looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must be diligent today. To wait till tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? The sage calls a person who dwells in mindfulness night and day the one who knows the better way to live alone. It's great. It's wonderful. He starts it off with, do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. And, I sat Zazen for about 6-7 hours a day for a month, and I still did that. And even during month number 3, I lost myself in the past and the future. But there was a difference, witnessing that occurred to it. It's palpable. The Buddha goes on to say, and I'm not going to quote everything, something that these Pali Sutras kind of do is the Buddha likes to repeat himself. So I'll do it one time and then I'll say, and then he said all that stuff again, and then you'll get it. So it says, monks, what do we mean by pursuing the past? It says, when someone considers the way her body was in the past, the way her feelings were in the past, the way her perceptions were in the past, the way her mental formations were in the past, the way her consciousness was in the past, when she considers these things and her mind is burdened by and attached to these things which belong to the past, then that person is pursuing the past. This, I feel like that's like the that's such a human description. I don't know of anyone who hasn't done this in their life. Well, better yet, he helps us out. He says, what is meant by not pursuing the past? Here's the juicy part. One of the juicy parts. He says, when someone considers the way that her body was in the past, the way her feelings were in the past, the way her perceptions were in the past, the way her mental formations were in the past, the way her consciousness was in the past, when she considers these things, but her mind is neither enslaved by nor attached to these things which belong to the past, then the person is not pursuing the past. So he basically repeated himself, right? And there's a very key difference. He says, when the mind is neither enslaved by or attached to these things which belong to the past, the person is not pursuing the past. So it's like, it's all still happening, right? Mind wanders, mind drifts. Mind does a lot of funny things. I can remember during the third month, Rohatsu Sesshin, which is 7 days at Tassajara, 7 days of about 8 to 9 hours of sitting. I was sitting at, just sitting, not much going on, staring at a white wall. All of a sudden, I started thinking about this video game that I had played maybe 6 years before I had been to Tassajara. I don't know what a white wall has to do with this video game, but it comes up. It's there. It happens. It happens to me when I come, I come back from Tassajara, very calm, I was saying this kind of sarcastically, very sage-like, very, focused, and, just sitting there still trying to qualify my existence by my past thoughts. I mean, the past and future thoughts are very, 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 very important for something that wants to exist all the time, for something that needs continuity. If you don't have a story of where you've been and where you're going, then you can't have you can't have a separate self. And it's very important. One of the cool things about sitting for 6 to 7 hours a day is that the story gets a little fuzzy. And you kind of, I think during month two, I completely even forgot where I was. You know, during work circle announcements, the work leader said, "Here at Tassajara, dot, dot, dot." And I said, "Oh my God, we're at Tassajara. How about that?" You know, it's like the story was being interrupted so constantly that I was, you know, wasn't enslaved by it at that point in time. Happened sometimes, but, you know. Yeah. So the past no longer is, the future has not yet come. This is how it actually is. Past no longer is, the future has not yet come. So we try to pursue the past, we try to lose ourselves in the future, we try to make these plans, but the reality of it is that the past no longer is, and the future has not yet come. What is there left? Looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. And freedom is awesome for Buddhists, because I feel like the whole Buddhist thing is about freedom. It's about liberation. And knowing the better way to live alone, and relying on Prajnaparamita, and having nothing to attain, is this liberative teaching. It's this liberative way of life. It's realizing nirvana. It's palpable freedom in the here and now. And the Buddha says we must be diligent today. To wait till tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. And what better a reminder of that than this paramount figure, Steve Suki, being told he has 3 months to live and watching some of his very good friends go through this experience of having to let go of their good friend quickly because he doesn't have much time. I think that this teaching of this better way to live alone, Steve Stuckey kind of, the stories I would hear about him being, you know, going through the chemo treatments, just looking totally wasted from activities, and just hearing about how his spirit endured, and just the energy that was there while this whole thing. I mean, the guy was living not in the past, not in the future, but right there. You know, he had a deep knowing that, you know, it's ending, that life ends. I mean, it's funny that he has this, it's obvious when he's dying that he has this knowledge and this truth exists, but actually this truth exists all the time. Life is incredibly uncertain and death is always close. Always close. In the third month, it was about 18 degrees out, and I lived in a cabin that had no heat. And I found a way to take a 0-degree sleeping bag and wrap my 30-to-50-degree sleeping bag in it. And then I had a scarf and I had a hat and I had some gloves. And the air was so cold that when I was breathing, it didn't feel like anything was happening. It felt like air was just going straight through me. And I started to get a little lightheaded, and you get, you know, finger pricks in the finger, and I'm like, you know what, this could be it. Right here at Tassajara. It's like, it's the third month, I went all the way through it, and I'm going to die because I can't breathe. You know, it's just... yeah, you know, it's... I don't know if there's anything much more to say than death is so close to us all. And in that knowing, there is great liberation, and there is great freedom from fear. I think the Buddha himself said that a great practice is to think about your own demise on a daily basis, to keep that something in the forefront. So he says, we must be diligent today, to wait till tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? How can we bargain with it? Yet we try so hard to do so. So I want to skip a little bit through this Yeah, here it is. It says, monks, what is meant by not being swept away by the present? This is beautiful. He says, when someone studies and learns about the awakened one, the teachings of love and understanding and the community that lives in harmony and awareness, when that person knows about noble teachers and their teachings, practices these teachings, and does not think, this body is myself, I am this body, these feelings are myself, I am these feelings, this perception is myself, I am this perception, this mental formation is myself, I am this mental formation, this consciousness is myself, I am this consciousness, then that person is not being swept away by the present. So he says, when you don't think that this body is myself, I am this body, these feelings are myself, I am these feelings, these perception is myself, I am this, like, where are you then? You know, if you're not these things, where are you? It says, this mental formation is myself, I am this mental formation, this consciousness is myself. If you don't have a consciousness or a mental formation, if this isn't who I am, what's left? And sometimes when you read these Pali, or when I read these Pali sutras, it's like a, like the Zen teachings, you know, these Mahayana teachings are just like, it's so clear that like there's this path from these Pali teachings up to this Mahayana teachings. And when I read this, I'm just like, oh wow, yeah, there's our teachings, there's Dogen, and there's all the ancestors telling us to have no idea about what we are. In order for a teaching to be considered Buddha Dharma, even though the Diamond Sutra says all dharmas are Buddha Dharma, but in order for a teaching to be considered Buddha Dharma, it has to have three aspects. It has to have, or three qualities, I guess. It's a no self has to be in the, it's one of the qualities, impermanence, and then it has to have nirvana or dependent co-rising kind of teaching in there. And this part is, I feel like he's getting onto that no self teaching. And I think the no self teaching is so incredibly hard to understand on purpose or not on purpose. There is actually no purpose to be found in it. It's, I think the common misconception in this teaching is when you hear no self, then that means there's no self. But the actual teaching of no self has four qualities. Has the first part is that there is a self. Second part is that there is no self. The third part is that there is a past self. And the fourth part is that there is a future self. And the cool thing about it is if you buy into any one of those qualities, then you are running into an extreme. Like, for instance, if you think that there's a self, that's in Buddhist time, they would say that it's like an Atman kind of teaching. Like, you would think there's a soul, like there's a permanent quality. And one of the things that's unique about humans is that when we buy into something completely, a dualistic idea of like there is a self, eventually the other thing comes around. And you'll have that nihilistic view come about. You'll have the other extreme come about. So this no self teaching requires us to take these four characteristics in all at one time, which is impossible for our dualistic mind. It just completely blows it apart. We think of things as high and low, smelly, not smelly. Pretty and ugly, you know, all these dualistic ideas, our discriminating mind is based on this. It's what it does. And in order to understand this no self teaching, you have to have, you kind of have to give up on this discriminative mind and say, in order to take all these four into account, I have to have absolutely no idea of what self is. There's completely, absolutely no idea. I am not this body, I am not this mind. Not this consciousness. He gives this whole list. Is to have completely no idea as to what self is. And with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita. Unless the mind is without hindrance there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. And I think I'll stop there.